So good morning and welcome to Church of the King. I am Pastor Michelle Harding, and we are continuing our series on Love Changed Everything. And what we are doing is we are looking first at the covenantal foundation of the Bible and seeing God through that and how this covenantal journey with God, with humanity, is pointing us constantly to love. That love has always been present. It didn't just show up when Jesus did, but this has always been the driving force of the Father and his heart toward humanity, and how ultimately when Jesus comes, that love changes absolutely everything. And so we need to realize he also changed everything about us if we're willing to accept that as the truth and to continue to walk in it. But we have been discussing over the last few weeks, we covered the Edenic Covenant, which is very much about origins, right? It's about our beginnings. Some very specific things about our beginnings and the nature in which we were created, how God saw us, the nature in which creation was made and how God saw it, man's place in it, woman's place in it. And then last week we stepped into the Adamic Covenant, which is basically what happens after Adam and Eve together eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And when they do, death comes in. And so we discussed what happens as a result. We discussed the commitment God made, and that even before there is any, this is the result of what's going to happen because of this. He blessed them with the promise of redemption, that it was there at the very beginning. And I want us to look into our next covenant, which is the Noahic Covenant, and begin to look also at the redemptive story of Noah. And you will find the Noah Covenant and the canon around the Noah Covenant in Genesis 6 to 9. But this is a covenant that is perpetual. It's everlasting. And it is also a grant covenant. If you remember a few weeks ago, we discussed grant covenant, kinship covenant, and vassal covenant. And a grant covenant being that which a king would grant everything and have no expectations, right, on the part of the other, and it was just blessing and take care of. And the vassal was one in which a covenant would be made from the higher to the lesser, and there would be stipulations, blessings and cursings and all of those things. And then the kinship is more like a marriage. It's like a partnership. It's where two equals choose to walk together, right? And so most people, of course, are familiar with the story of Noah. And so it either conjures up happy Sunday school stories about Noah and his wife and all the animals coming two by two, or it reminds us of baby nurseries and all the cute caricatures, right, and Sunday schools and rainbows. Or you may flash to images as you've gotten older in artwork of stormy waters and darkness and people drowning. And almost everyone universally knows that the rainbow represents promise. No matter what faith they are, that is how it is seen. So it's very interesting. And so, now I want to say that there are some tough things in this canon, chapter 6 through 9. Lots of things that are debated, lots of things that have been changed over the course of many years as far as view because of historical data, because of science, because of archaeology, because of finding Dead Sea Scrolls, because of lots of things. And we're not going to go into the nuances of a whole lot, but I am going to get into nuances of a few things. So bear with me, because remember, the purpose of this is we are relaying foundations. Part of an apostolic work is to relay foundations so we can build again, so we can rebuild, right, according to Jesus Christ, our chief cornerstone. And so our approach to the Bible is one in which we want to see all things through the lens of Christ, through the story of redemption, so that we don't have a schizophrenic God in the Old Testament that is different from the God of the New Covenant, right? And so we are going to begin to look at some of this and begin to break some of these things down that maybe we question, but we just push off because you're not supposed to ask those questions, right? And because, well, if I doubt, then maybe I'm not a good Christian. I'm not a good believer, and all those things, which actually isn't a very Hebrew mindset. I don't know if you know that. Hebrews left room for mystery. The Hebrew mindset says God doesn't have to be answered to, and that he doesn't have to answer everything, and that there is room for mystery. But even in the mystery, there is answers. That's what the Hebrew mindset believes. Our Greek-oriented Roman mindset, which is the Western civilization that grew out of that, that has crafted our education systems, our government, our law, sees things very differently. We want A plus B to equal C. We want 1 plus 1 to always equal 2. Where the Hebrews approach things with a block theology and allow things to not necessarily have to be all in line with an explanation. And so with that being said, okay, remember, again, we're looking for the redemptive purpose through the lens of Christ, ultimately love, so that we will not get caught up in these little things, but allow those things, if there are things that we touch on that quicken your imagination, go study them. Ask me for some book recommendations. Ask me if I can find you book recommendations. We can't necessarily answer everything, or we'll be like I am at Bible study on Wednesdays, which is 3 days and two verses, right? I mean, that's the way that will go. And so because we want to get through this as quickly but as saturated with truth and revelation as we can, we're not going to pull out every little thing, but I am going to touch on a few things because there are multiple ways to see them, and maybe some of those ways you have not been presented before, but you have room to make your own decision. It's called freedom. And so I want to spend some time on something that I mentioned last week about how there are different approaches to reading the first 10 chapters of Genesis, that some look at it all as allegory, some look at it all as myths that have from Jewish tradition, lots of ways that it's seen. But I want us to really look at the way that a solid biblical approach would be taken. And so first thing I want us to know is that in theology, there is eisegesis and there is exegesis. Eisegesis, exegesis. Eisegesis is when we interpret the Bible by our own understanding. It's our own interpretation. It's highly subjective, and it's usually based on the interpreter's bias. Then there's exegesis. This is where we critically interpret the Bible. It's where we approach the text that we're reading, the book we're reading, or the entire book that we're reading to discover its actual intended meaning. Under exegesis is what is known as the quadra, right here. Okay? Guess I should have written it down. Where's my pen? Let me pronounce that correctly. It is called the quadriga. That's an R and an I. Quadriga. And it's named after the Roman chariot that would have been pulled by four horses abreast. And so we need to think about interpretation of the Bible is best understood not through one perspective in doing proper exegesis. But there are four thoughts, four courses of study that is the best way to approach Scripture holistically, okay? And they are literal, the moral, the allegory, and the anagogic. Anagogic. And so I want to tell you a little bit more about these. This method has actually been followed since the earliest church fathers. It's not practiced enough today. The quadriga refers to that chariot that is four horses across that is pulling for speed and for might and for strength. The four horses symbolize the four sub-methods. So this would be a chariot being drawn by four horses. And so that list of four methods of scriptural interpretation, literal, allegorical, moral, and the Anagogical. I got it. So those, I want you to think about this as I go through this, that when you are studying the Bible, you're going to be looking for all four levels of understanding. Because the Bible is not just a history book. It's divine revelation. It's not just a record of what man did. It is a record of how man discovered God, how God unveiled himself. It is a journey of humanity out of darkness into light. And so in that, you can't find the literal part of that. But in the deeper text and the purpose of God's writing this book, you will see all of these facets. So the literal interpretation, which is the first one you see there, holds that we first look for the plain meaning that's being conveyed in what we're reading and who the author is. This is where we look to word definitions. This is where we look for grammar. This is where we look for historical and cultural context. Who's writing it? Who are they writing it to? Why was it written? What's going on in history? Is Israel free or is Israel captive? Is this pre-Sinai or after Sinai? All of these things come into that study. The problem is that in many modern seminaries and universities, the literal meaning is usually the focus of nearly all study. It is, and you will hear me say, historical cultural matters, because it does. But we can't be without the spiritual revelation of why that's important. And so a lot of them have completely abandoned the spiritual methods that the church fathers used. What is the ethical responsibility now of what I know? What is the allegory? What does it represent? What else is it speaking to in my life now? And then also the anagogical, same word. And so these are the more spiritual. They're more not the facts as much as they are understanding. This is where we move what we learn into what we know. This is how these other three ideas is how we don't just know something, but begin to live something. This is where the truth becomes transformational. This is the place, these areas of study, is where what I'm talking to you about, sorry, I have this one hair, get out of the way. That when I say that you have to practice the disciplines of things like meditation and prayer, right, and contemplation and reflection, this is why. Because that is where we discover the moral, ethical implications of what I'm reading. How does it transform how I think and what I believe about myself, about others, about the world, about God? And then we have allegory and anagogic. I'm going to learn that word before it's over with. And I'm going to go in a little more for this. The allegorical interprets the Bible through the understanding that there is another level, that there's more to know. It's the reference beyond the people, beyond the things that I'm reading about, beyond the events that are specifically mentioned. It's a common form of allegory, that you will hear a lot of people say is typology, right? And that's where you'll hear us preachers say Moses is a type of Christ, right? The ark is a type of Christ. So it's that idea of types and shadows. So we see that. But most of what we have done is we've taken the type and shadow and said, oh, that's good to know. I see that. But the question must become more internalized. How does this matter? Why does this matter? How does this person or this event transform how I see God, how I see man? Because this book, above all, if the greatest commandment Jesus says is love God and love one another, at all times I want to be knowing, how does it teach me more about this loving, amazing God that I know and how to love others? That is a primary lens in which I want to even see allegory through, because that's the only way I'll be transformed into Christ. It is through love. So the moral interpretation or the ethical interpretation is called tropological interpretation, a more theological terms. It's basically finding out the moral. No, I'm sorry. Goodness, we already did. Did I do moral? Yeah. So allegorical, I just stepped over my own teaching back there, though. This is finding out the moral of the story, the ethics, or how one should act now. Many of Jesus's parables and the book of Proverbs and other wisdom books are packed with tropological meaning. And then there is the anagogic interpretation. The Greek word here is to climb or ascend. This word, anagogic, literally means to climb or to ascend. So think about that. It's not to be puffed up with what you know. It is to ascend into heavens, into the realities of God, into the realities of the kingdom in your spirit, in your heart, where you become more like what you seek. This is the idea that I am climbing into God. I am growing up into Christ, the maturity that Ephesians chapter 4 speaks of, fully maturing into the head of the one whose body we now are. So that the body doesn't, so the body isn't walking around looking like a bobblehead. You know what a bobblehead is, right? Those giant, big-headed things sitting on these little bodies. Unfortunately, I believe that's more what the church looks like. But we should be growing up into Christ so that we match the head, not being bobbleheads. It seeks the higher spiritual meaning from the literal. So you have to have the literal. It's not a total abandonment about what really happened and what's going on historically. But is what is God trying to communicate that is higher for me, that is a higher revelation of himself, that's a higher revelation of humanity than I may currently have? It is to seek the ecstaticism, the ecstasy of God. This is where the passion and the fire merge with what we know to the one of who we know. And it's where the realms of heaven and things begin to come clearer and clearer in this place. There's a Latin poem that survived from the early Middle Ages that goes like this. Because remember, we're still talking about Bible interpretation, and that this is the way that our fathers, the forefathers of the faith, the early church fathers, this was the way they approached the word. And so in the Latin poem that survived, the scholars use this poem to remember these four interpretations. And so it's roughly translated this way. The literal teaches what God and our ancestors did. The allegory is where our faith and belief is hid. The moral meaning gives us the rule of our daily life. And the anagogy shows us where we end our strife. Not where we end up, not ending in heaven, but where we end our strife. Interesting that it's in this place of higher ascension that the war within ourselves ends. It is where the war with our understanding and God's understanding ends. It's where the war with one another ends. It's where the war with racism ends. It's where the war of misogyny ends. It's where the war of every ism that is found in the nations ends. It is in that revelation, just as these scholars understood, that that is the place in which the strife, my trying to earn God's attention, my trying to earn God's approval, trying to earn God's favor, where I get to rest in the rhythm of his grace. It comes in this place. And what we have to understand is that that's not found in listening to me talk. I'm opening a door of information, but it's up to you to make it your revelation. And it comes through understanding these views of what you hear from me today and any other day and any other preacher and any other teaching that you get. How does it become a part of my daily life? How does it teach me to live every single day? How do I hide my faith and my belief in the certainty of what I'm seeing here? And how does this lead me to end the strife and the reckoning that I have within myself? Because that's the purpose. For too long, it has been what we know. And we've been taught what we know so we can defend our faith. Like God needs defending. I just think there's a better way. And so when we think about this for ourselves, here's how you can think about this, okay? When you think about these four areas of interpretation. And so what you could easily do without having to know all these words that, I shouldn't step out of the frame. Sorry. What you can do is, instead of having to know all these words, remember these arrows. See, the literal points us back to history, what was happening, to the culture, to the times. The allegory points us to the future. It points us to how this becomes part of me. How do I hide my faith in this? How do I expand my faith in this? How do I gain grace from this? It's the story behind what is literally there. And then there is the moral and ethic. That arrow points to us. He says, how does it affect my daily life? How do I live on a daily way that this impacts my life? And then the last one, the anagogic, would be upward. Because remember, it means ascend. It's the picture of rising in him. And so every day when I'm reading my Bible, I don't want to just know what I read. I want to know how what I read, literal, changes who I am. Transforms me into the image of the one, the higher, that I'm seeking. And then allows me to move that faith forward and to help other people. The purpose of going to church is not just so we can stay still and keep worshiping where we're at. It is as a body coming together, being transformed, so that we can keep shifting and moving the message of Jesus forward, but not just his message, the transformation of life in him. And so you're like, okay, but why are we talking about this when we're supposed to be talking about Noah's covenant? You'll understand momentarily. And so just to let you know, just one of our early church fathers, whose name is Origen, depending on who and how they say it, who lived in Alexandria in 184 to 253 AD. So we're talking within the first 300 years, which is considered the early church fathers. He was a Christian scholar, a theologian, an ascetic, which means that he was one who did not participate in anything in the world. He was fully withdrawn, very much like a monk, but still a part of the theological scholarly life that was there in Alexandria. He wrote more than 2,000 treatises, which would be like books in our day. Because he didn't have somebody to type it on the computer. These are handwritten things in multiple branches of theology. But he had one treatise that he wrote called First Principles. And what he said is that he recommended that the Old and the New Testament be interpreted allegorically at three levels: the flesh, the soul, and the spirit. And so if you look at these, that's what these are. The flesh, how do I act morally? The soul, the allegory. How does this affect my mind, my will, my emotions? How does this change how I'm relating and seeing the world and those around me? And then the anagogic, which is the spiritual, the higher place. This is how those who walked the closest to Jesus, other than the disciples, studied the word. This is how they approached it. It wasn't their design. They learned this from Hebrew scholars and Greek scholars, but Hebrew, Jewish people followed this. The reason that we have, Kabbalism? Kabbalism is the Kabbalah, right? Which is the Hebrew study of numbers and those different things. That was part of Jewish mysticism. So when you hear all these prophets talk about the year of the Lord, 5871, they're actually practicing what was taught through the Kabbalah by Jewish mystics. That's the truth. And now, just so in case you don't know, this is just sidebar for anybody that's watching and anybody listening. There are whole years missing out of the Jewish calendar. Like, there's whole time periods, 713 years, that they don't have. They also operate on a lunar cycle rather than our cycle. So we have to have a leap year every 3 years. Why? Because it's actually 365 and a third days to get around the sun. So every 3 years, we add an extra day so that time can catch up. So even those Hebrew numbers isn't necessarily the right year that they're claiming. I'm just saying. Just a way to look at it. It's why I personally don't put a whole lot of faith in it anymore. Okay, that rabbit hole and cow is slaughtered. Let's move on. We can talk about that more if anybody wants to know a little bit more about that later. So anyway, Origin states that the many events recounted in Scripture, they are interpreted in literal or fleshly sense, are impossible or nonsensical. He says, if it's only literal or in what your brain can conceive, it's kind of impossible and it's nonsensical. Virgin birth, right? Walking on water. There, if it's just looked at that way, then it doesn't make sense. I mean, we have the miraculous too, but you have to believe that there's something more than the literal. And so then he also goes on to say, lost my spot, sorry. Okay. They must be interpreted allegorically to be understood. Then there's some passages that have parts that are literally true, but also continue on with parts that are literally impossible. So then the reader must endeavor to grasp the entire meaning connecting the intellectual process with the literal process and connect those things with the allegory and the ethic idea of the flesh, the spirit, and the soul. It is the only way, basically what he's saying is the only way for us to get an accurate interpretation of what's really being said. Because if not, we run into contradictions that we can't answer. These kinds of things that throw us off because we haven't been taught a fuller way of understanding the Scriptures. So in light of this, I want us to understand that the story of Noah needs to be looked at through a holistic biblical interpretation of all areas and seen from that perspective. So finally, let's look at the Noah Covenant, which is found in Genesis chapter 6 through 9. I'm not going to read the whole thing. Looking at time. I'm not going to read every single bit, but we will touch on a good amount. Okay? So just turn there. Now, one of the things that many scholars consider is that Noah's flood is actually part of the genre of myth. I'm not saying that it didn't happen. It's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that Noah's flood did not happen. I'm not saying that at all. But I am saying that the primary purpose of the story must be understood that it's not a journalistic record of an event. This wasn't God writing the presses of the accounts of today like we're used to picking up a newspaper and reading. Okay? That's not the purpose. What we have to understand is that a myth is told to make a moral point. It's to speak of to a moral point, a moral reality, to help a people become more moral. That's its purpose. That's the purpose of a myth. So above the, whether it's factual or not, or all the things that we will discuss are the nuances of this that could be, that what we do know is there's a moral story here that was intended for humanity to receive, to know something, see something, and morally be changed because of it. Moral, right? The moral ethical study. That's important. And in that, what we're looking for is that this story is to tell us who we are, who God is, to understand what God is doing or going to do, and to help understand suffering and that bad things happen. That's what the story is about. So first, I want us to realize that the flood myth, right, is a myth that crosses a wide range of cultures, from tribes in Africa to Egypt. 24 tribes of indigenous people in northern, southern, and central America have a flood myth. The Sumerians and the Mesopotamian nations have flood myths. Ancient China also India, Korea, Malaysia, Taiwan, the ancient Greeks, as well as the Polynesian and the Norse legends, the Vikings, all have myths, stories about a flood and a man and one or two or more people that are saved with him. Some are in canoes with skins. Some are in a boat. Some are in an ark. But this story is consistent throughout humanity. So whether it's literal only, or if it is a myth that was brought into the Hebrew Bible, isn't as important as what's being said. It doesn't change the goodness of God. It doesn't change the beauty, the dynamics, and the power of his word. Okay? I know. So all of these accounts depict a flood. Sometimes it's a global, it's on a global scale. Sometimes it's regional. Sometimes it's local. It's usually sent by a deity or deities to destroy civilizations as an act of divine judgment. Every story contains that. Most of these stories have an interesting and consistent part in them that you don't find in God's story. In almost all of them, the people do something that ticks that God or gods off. It makes them angry. Now, what I want you to understand is that that's the way most people see Noah's story, but I want to challenge that. I want to challenge that. Because I believe that it's telling us something different if we will look at the text a little deeper. So in all of that, there's this idea that something that these people did, these little subhumans had done, that tick this God off. They didn't worship him, or in one case, the increasing population is too loud and the gods can't sleep. So they send a flood to control the population because just too many of us were just too loud down here. And then there's in Egypt, Ra is angry because the people are unfaithful to him and he feels disrespected. So he destroys the whole world in a flood of blood, or is going to, but stops it. So, it shouldn't shake you. It shouldn't shake your faith. It's not saying the Bible's not true. It's saying we haven't looked at it in the way it was supposed to be looked at. Or I'm challenging you at least to look at it in a different way. Okay? So when we look at the text carefully, keeping in mind that we are seeing the Bible as a story of God walking with man, of God revealing himself to humanity. And what we see is God grieved by what man is doing to man. When we look at this story in Genesis chapter 6, this is what I want to point out first in the differences, the narratives of those other myths and this one. Look at Genesis chapter 6, starting in verse 1. Now it came about when men began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. Then the Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he also is flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. Verse 4, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward when the sons of God came in the daughters of men, they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old and men of renown. Now, these are things that people get caught up in and they fight over and create things. This passage of scripture has been used to affirm that aliens were on the land. This passage has been used to say that it's also been said that this is where demons were mating with people. Some say demons filled man and mated with people, because there's challenges to that belief, because Jesus says that in the afterlife there, that we won't be married because we will be like the angels and can't procreate and don't marry. Right? Not procreate, but marry. But then you have Peter and Jude who talk about these beings that are imprisoned from during the flood. So my point in saying any of that is it could go anyway. It could be true. It could be different. There are scriptures that theologians support every one of those beliefs. There's another much more commonly held belief now by modern theologians, and that is that the sons of God were the sons of the lineage of Seth, and that the sons of man were of the lineage of Cain. Because remember, Cain had been marked and had been sent out. So you had two different kinds of people. So some also speak about how that speaks to the day in salvation, that those who are Jewish and those who are not, the sand and the stars in Abraham's vision, right? Jews and Gentiles in the kingdom represented here. Again, there's room for that. There's no hard or soft way for me. It doesn't shake who God is or anything about this text to see any of those ways as true. Okay? So don't let it. These are perspectives. They're ways to look at things that you probably have never heard before but are widely held in theological schools of thought. Okay. So, also, so I want us to see here that it says, God is, these words are describing what God is seeing, right? He's telling us what is happening in the earth. Then we go on to verse 5. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. The Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. And the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, and man to animals, to creeping things, and to birds of the sky, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. So I want us to pause there. So what I want us to see is that God is grieved not by what man has done to him, but do you see it? But what they are doing to one another and what they are doing to the earth. You got to remember that Adam was made a co-creator with God. He was put in the garden to gardenize the world. That Adam, meaning mankind, not the guy Adam, but mankind was placed to be co-creators with God, to gardenize the earth with all that God, the benevolence of God, all that God had given them, anything that was outline of that, to subdue it and bring it under subjugation. And so here they are, and there is evil corrupting everything. And God isn't angry that they're not worshiping him. He doesn't say that. We don't know if they worshiped him or not. Doesn't say so. Do you see that? In the script. He doesn't say, I'm offended because they're not worshiping me. I'm offended because they're not giving me my offerings. Not the way these other myth stories did. He's not saying you're loud and you're reckless and you're disturbing me. His heart was broken for what he saw. That's a different picture. The other gods were angry. God is grieved. The other gods want vindication and violence. God's heart is broken. You've got to see that first. Not God judged and a flood came and wiped them all out because they were so evil. That's the narrative we've told ourselves. But it's a bigger picture than that. So I want us to see this because we're laying a foundation of love, a foundation of redemption, a foundation of God's desire to reveal himself to humanity. Because that's what this book is about. So that the God in you will be revealed to humanity and to all creation. So it's a stark contrast. You remember the story I mentioned earlier about the great populace disturbing the gods who were asleep and they couldn't sleep? It's found in the Epic of Atrahasis, which is recorded on clay tablets for about 1800 years before Christ. They were found in ancient Mesopotamia. So this flood story was a basic myth told throughout the cradle of civilization, which is where the Bible here, where this part of the Bible is believed to also be taking place. But we see the God of our Bible. We see Elohim, God creator. We see Yahweh. We see him coming in his heart and his mind differently than this other gods did. And if you can go and find a lot of these stories yourself and read them. Look for ancient myths of ancient civilizations or creation myths or flood myths. You'll find them all over the internet. So we need to see that this is pointing out in the Bible, something is happening here. Something is different. It's something different from these other gods and these other cultures. God is grieved because of those he is called to partner with, to co-create with. They're destroying one another in the earth. And so as I quoted in 6:6, it says, so the Lord was sorry. Or some scriptures say the Lord repented that he had made mankind on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart, or he was heartbroken. The word here for sorry or repented must be seen differently than the way that we understand repentance. It's not even changing his mind, the way that we see that in the New Testament in Greek thought. This idea here, this is the word naham, N-A-C-H-A-M, naham.